Thank you, James, and my name is Bob Doppelt. I'm from another rainy place on Earth called Oregon in the USA. Although it's sort of like London, I think that we tell everybody it rains all the time there, but it really doesn't. But that brings people to California rather than to Oregon. I am a professor at the University of Oregon, where I teach systems thinking and climate change policy and program development. I'm actually trained as a counseling psychologist, as well as an environmental scientist. And I've tried to merge those fields throughout my career. But at the same time, for the last 27 years, I've practiced socially engaged Buddhism. And for many years, it seemed like two different tracks. That socially engaged Buddhism and my work on climate issues and environmental issues from a psychological, from a human change perspective, it seemed like those were two different things, or at least they were parallel. And about 10 years ago, I guess 12 years ago, it became clear to me that, in fact, principles of the Dharma are the same principles that we need to use to address issues like climate change and sustainability. In fact, once this once I came to this awareness, which is like, duh, after many, many years, it became obvious to me and very, very clear how they merged together. So the last 10 years of my career, I've really focused on merging those two. But I work quite a bit with local and state and federal government agencies in the U.S. and private companies. And it's very difficult to talk about Buddhism or the Dharma in those terms with those entities. There's a reaction that turns people off. So I use mainstream language to talk and describe Buddhist principles and the Dharma. At the same time, I get an opportunity every now and then, like tonight, to actually talk in terms of the Dharma and what these principles mean. And that's what I want to do with you here tonight, if that's okay. And I want to thank Louise for setting up this event and James for helping me get sort of oriented tonight and to London Insight in general for allowing me to be here and to set this up. And I apologize, it feels like I'm doing a church sermon or something, but I just keep some notes and I don't know any other way to do that. Let me also say that tonight is a rather important evening for all of us. If you know about the storm that is already hitting the east coast of the U.S., it is an historic event, never before seen in North America, so we believe. We'll see what happens tonight. It is clearly a climate change-related event, although for weeks people will argue about that because it's very difficult to trace back one event to climate change. Because of my work, I'm very involved with the political process in the U.S., and I don't know how many of you follow it, but we're about to have an election, and neither candidate, neither President Obama or his challenger, Mitt Romney, would talk about climate change, which I consider to be an unbelievable statement. And I think it's sort of, it's a perfect timing, if you will, for such a tragic event. If we're going to have something like this now, we might as well have it now, because if they don't talk about it now, it's going to be rather remarkable. But in the U.S., it's very difficult to talk about this. I work in many other countries around the world, and it's not that way. But in the U.S., we're still sort of stuck in the mud on this issue. And maybe this will be a wake-up call. So we'll see. I think it could actually affect the election in many ways, and so we'll see what happens with this. But I'm here to talk about my new book again, which tries to take basic Buddhist principles, the Dharma, and interpret them in a way that into mainstream language without Buddhist language or terms that the average person can use to transform their thinking and behavior to address problems like climate change but also growing economic inequality that we have here in this country and in the U.S. and elsewhere, the collapse of the economy, which we've seen, and many, many issues. They're very all intertwined. They're very all connected, and I'll talk about that tonight. And I think the way out, if you will, the solution, really has to do with following basic economic principles. So I'm going to talk for a few minutes, and then actually ask you, if you're willing, to do a short meditation. Then I'll talk again, and we'll go sort of back in and out of that process. The meditation is aimed at helping you sort of just internalize what I've talked about. And hopefully we'll be done, or should be done, just around 9 o'clock, and then I'm happy to stay for questions and discussion. So I want to start by asking all of you, how many of you think you know what drives your behavior? Why do you do, how many think you know why you do what you do? One, two, okay, some brave souls.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Okay, sometimes you're right. That's more than most, by the way, when I asked that question. How many do you think you know how to change your behavior? If you want to lose weight, you can lose weight. If you want to stop smoking, you can stop smoking and get more exercise. How many of you really think you know how to change your behavior?
Sometimes.
Okay. All right. Again, that's more than most. I just talked to a business group yesterday, and nobody answered yes to either, though. So, except they were looking at their bosses.
Yes.
And how many of you think of yourself as a change agent? That your job or your role in life is to motivate other people in some way, or your organizations that you work with, to sort of think and act in a more sustainable or more healthy way. Anybody? Okay. All right. Many more people praise this. Now, here's the conundrum, right? If you're not sure what drives your own behavior, and you're not sure how to change your own behavior, how can you help others change their behavior? That's always the struggle we are in when we're in the helping professions, if you will, and I think all of you in one form or another, whether directly or indirectly, are in that. And it is, it's especially important today because with climate disruption, economic inequality, the economic breakdown we've had, and so many other issues challenging us, our greatest need now is to find a way to motivate ourselves to alter our thinking and our behavior, and then once we've done that, to motivate other people, our families, our communities, eventually our governments and business institutions to change their thinking and behavior, because we've got some tough times ahead. As this storm on the East Coast now says, no matter how it plays out, this is just the beginning of some very tough times that lies ahead of us. And so we're going to have to figure out how to make our way through that. I think that in different terms, again, we need to find a way where everyone begins to think and act and become accountable for what I call sustainable thinking and behavior. Ecologically and socially sustainable thinking and behavior. In Buddhist terms, like I said, I think that simply means we have to help people really understand and learn how to follow the Dharma. That's really what this is about. And this requires a fundamental shift from focusing always on ourselves, on what I want for me right now, any way I can get it, without really worrying about the consequence. I'm focusing on me, to a fundamental shift to always trying to care for and restore other people and the ecological systems that sustain and support all of them and us. So that's the big we. So I think sustainable thinking to me and acting is really about a fundamental shift from me to we. And I think when you look at the Dharma, that's exactly what the Dharma is about. That's exactly what the Buddha talked about. Shifting from selfishness to selflessness. That's at the core of the Dharma, and that's at the core of what's going to have to happen to address these problems that we're facing today. And that's why I wrote this new book, From Me to We, that I'm going to share with you tonight and help you understand, written in mainstream language without Buddhist jargon, but I'm going to explain how these points connect with the Dharma to really help folks understand what's involved. How do we make this fundamental shift from focusing only on ourselves, from a selfishness that we seem to, that is really prevalent here in your country and extremely prevalent in the U.S., to a much broader focus on selflessness. So I'm going to start by suggesting that the shift from me to we, as I call it, or from selfishness to selflessness or much greater selflessness, can be thought of as five interrelated commitments. And these commitments are not new at all. Again, the Buddha talked about them many, thousands of years ago, and many other wise people have talked about them throughout time. And physical and social scientists talk about them also. But I don't think they've been put into a framework, at least with the groups and organizations I work, that help people understand how to change their thinking and behavior and move in this direction. So that's what I've tried to do. By the end of the evening, I'd like your feedback. Are any of the principles we've talked about new, really, for you? But also, are they framed in a way that's now helpful to help to allow you to sort of figure out how you can work with them and how other people can work with them? I think these universal truths, if you will, are really important today because they really do help us align our thinking and behavior with what I call the natural laws of sustainability. And these natural laws are the universal truths about how we humans must interact with each other today and with the natural environment if we're going to transition through a 10 to 20, 25 year very difficult time and come out the other end in a much healthier, stable, and sustainable situation. And these natural laws are the laws of the Dharma. In fact, if you read the Buddha's words carefully, you realize he said that he learned and figured out the Dharma by sitting under a tree and watching the way nature worked. So the Dharma are merely the laws of nature, and that's why they call these natural laws of sustainability. These are the truths inherent in the Dharma. I'm also going to emphasize commitments, five commitments. And the commitments are essentially a vow. They reflect our sense of purpose, our priorities, and our values. What we decide to think about, what we decide to focus on, makes all the difference in the world in terms of how we behave, as we know from following Buddhist principles. And if we make an explicit commitment to think and act in a certain way, we are able to make a conscious choice about how we're going to proceed in the world. And that's what we're going to have to do now. We're going to have to make some very tough choices as time unfolds. And as the Buddha said, the ability to choose what we pay attention to and what we just let go by is the most powerful tool we have for raising our consciousness, for altering our lives, for finding happiness, and for creating a positive future for society and ourselves. And we expand our choices by altering the way we see the world, by altering our interpretations of the world. Or as the Buddha said, seeing through the illusions that control our minds. And seeing reality for really what it is. And this is essential because, as we've just found in U.S. politics and elsewhere, climate disruption and economic breakdown and growing economic inequalities, they're really not technical problems. They're not problems of policy. Climate change, yeah, might be directly caused by fossil fuels for the most part, but it's really not a fossil fuel problem. They are the result of erroneous thinking. They are a result of what's going on in our heads in our interpretation of how the world works and our role in it and what we should be doing. In fact, I consider climate disruption the greatest failure of thought in human history. That humans can foul our nest, our own nest, our only nest, so badly that we're not sure what the future brings for people in the future. That's a pretty serious error. And we've made those mistakes, humans have over time, but they've been localized. You know, they've been regionalized. Now we've globalized it. And that's one of the big differences. And it really occurred in the last 50 to 75 years. Environmental problems were local 50 years ago, 60 years ago for the most part. Now from climate disruption to ocean acidification and so many other issues, we've globalized these issues. And that's a whole different situation, but our thinking hasn't caught up with that in our way of addressing the world. So I'm going to suggest that the only way to resolve this greatest failure of thought in human history is to begin to clearly see how the planet functions and our role in it. And that's what I hope the shift from me to we can help you do. I'm going to suggest also that the five commitments are a mainstream approach to what you all know of, I think, is the cultivating the Bodhisattva way of life. And that's the true path to liberation that the Buddha talks about. And the Bodhisattva way of life flows naturally from cultivating an awakened mind, which is what we're going to have to help a lot of people doing. And this naturally flows from seeing the way the world works very clearly, and seeing through our illusions and controlling our emotions and controlling our behaviors, which we haven't been very good at doing over time. So again, I think what I believe this is about is really trying to help people find paths forward to shift from their all too common focus on me, on getting me what I want for myself right now, no matter what the consequences, to always trying to meet our needs by caring for a broader we, which means other people here and abroad and the ecological systems that support them. That is, shifting from a selfishness to a much greater focus on selflessness. And as Buddhism teaches us, and as our own experience and your own experience undoubtedly shows you, true happiness really results when we're compassionate with other people and we're giving to other people. That's really where all of us find our greatest happiness. And so and really the Buddha talked about the shift from me to we thousands of years ago, in different terms, of course, because they were dealing with different issues. They weren't dealing with climate change at the time. But it's never been more important than now. So I'd like to start, dive into these commitments, with just a very short exercise of time to sit, if you would, just by, if you would let yourself sit quietly, and if you're willing, gently close your eyes. You don't have to, but it's good. And invite your body to relax and release into the support given to you by the chair. You can let go of your tensions and any sense of having to do anything right now. And now just become aware of your breathing for a few moments. Notice your breath entering and leaving your body. And let go of any thoughts that come into your awareness as they come in. Now, as you know, focusing on the breath is a way to concentrate the mind. But it's actually much more than that. I invite you to bring your attention to what's actually happening each time you take a breath. And that is that you are inhaling oxygen. you're aware that only a small amount of the energy that your body uses actually comes from the food and the water you eat or drink? The vast majority of the energy you use comes from oxygen. Oxygen metabolizes your food, it metabolizes your water that you drink and turns it into energy. And oxygen is what detoxifies your bloodstream. And you would not be alive right now if you were not breathing this oxygen. Now, can you imagine where this oxygen is coming from? Can you bring your attention to the oxygen as it enters your body? Can you sense the cleansing of your bloodstream? Can you sense the energy that it's created through metabolism in your body? Now focus your mind on where this energy came from. About 3/4 of it was produced during a process called photosynthesis in single-cell green algae and bacteria in marine environments. And the rest of it comes from the same processes in forests and in other vegetation all around you. So complex processes occurring in the oceans and in the estuaries and in the landscapes all around you are producing the oxygen that you are breathing right now that are giving you life at this very moment. How conscious are you of that process? When you take a breath, do you always give thanks to the oceans and the vegetation that are allowing you to live? Of course not. That's not how we normally think, but that's reality. This is how life on our planet actually works. So here is a fundamental truth to ponder. Nothing exists on its own on this planet. Everything on our Earth, including you and me, is created by and sustained by other processes. This is what in mainstream language I call the law of interdependence, the natural law of interdependence, which is the first and most important natural law of sustainability. And in Buddhism, we call this emptiness and dependent origination. Nothing is a solid, independent entity in itself. All things arise in dependence upon multiple causes and conditions. Now, if you're willing, I'd like you to imagine for a few moments that you are seeing the world completely afresh. Instead of seeing yourself and all of the things as solid entities separate from each other, imagine that you are now seeing the energy and the materials that are constantly in motion, flowing through you, flowing into your body and out of your body, into other organisms and out of other organisms. Can you imagine or envision the continual flow of energy and materials from the microscopic bacteria in your body, through larger organs in your body, out of your body, into complex systems and organisms that make up the Earth's biosphere? Can you envision the energy and materials that are flowing from the Earth's climate into the oceans and back into oxygen and then back into carbon dioxide that you breathe out that goes back into the vegetation? You can envision this continually circling, complex flow of materials and energy, which you are actually seeing as the causes and conditions that make things what they are here on Earth. See if you can feel those elements and those processes. Where in your body can you experience them? Are you aware of the sensations somewhere, those elements coming in and leaving and moving? Now come back to your body, if you would, in your own pattern of breathing, if you would, and become more aware of your immediate surroundings. The Buddha said that we can give ourselves no greater gift, no amount of money, no jewels, or anything else that is greater than cultivating our own mindfulness. Nor can we give anyone a greater gift than cultivating our own mindfulness. So, give yourself a thank you for what you have just given yourself, increasing your own mindfulness. And then open your eyes and come back to the room, if you would. So as we just experienced, the boundaries we create to distinguish ourselves from other people, humans or ourselves from the natural environment, the economy from the social, so-called social systems, those are just illusions. They're not real. We humans create these fantasies in our minds that there's something separate, that we're somehow separate from everything else, in order to break the world down into smaller pieces and understand it better. That's okay, that's a natural process. But when we believe that they're real and not just illusions that we use to try to understand the world better, things become very dangerous and we get ourselves into trouble. And this directly applies to all of us. Anatta, which is no self in Buddhism, means that since all things change, there is no such thing as a separate or permanent self. Again, you're mostly just a medium. Our bodies are just mediums through which oxygen and energy and water move through. You bring it in and you let it go out. So who are you, really, if everything is always changing? And you just experience that by breathing. There is no separate me out there. Nothing exists on its own on this planet. And this is a core Dharma principle, and in what I call in mainstream language, the natural law of interdependence. We are all interdependent elements of much bigger and more complex systems. And if you're not constantly aware of the systems you're part of, of the bigger, broader elements and systems you're part of, if you're not constantly aware of the context in which you exist, you're likely to do more harm than good. And I think that's what we've done today on climate change and many other issues. And this leads to the first and most important commitment involved with the shift from me to we that I call being at the core of sustainable thinking and action. See the systems you're part of. We always have to strive to begin to understand the social and ecological context in which we exist. Just like your body is made up of smaller systems connected to larger systems, your heart, to your liver, to your, et cetera, all systems exist in sort of a hierarchical fashion. So you have to sort of see them from smaller to larger systems. And it seems as though it's difficult for people to understand systems and see systems because they're sort of amorphous. How do you see that? But actually, there are very practical ways if you're interested in doing that. And that's what I teach undergraduates. I teach freshmen in college to do systems mapping. And it's actually very easy, very fun. I have them do it starting with their own family, then their friends. If we have some time and anybody's interested, we can do some systems mapping just to sort of help. It's beyond just experiencing the systems, which you can do just as we've done, to go beyond that and see and map out systems. So systems thinking, systems mapping is a number of tools to help us see the systems we're part of. But unfortunately, most people who grow up in the Western nations today don't think this way, right? Because of our illusion of separateness, we don't try much to see the systems we're part of. By the way, it's getting warm in here. If you want to open the windows, please do.
Even further. These are open.
They're open.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This belief in separateness, which has always been endemic in humans, the Buddha talked about many, many thousands of years ago, was exacerbated and made worse starting about 350 years ago with the start of the Enlightenment here in Europe and the philosophies of John Locke and Thomas Hobbes and Adam Smith that came out of that. That was very much a reaction to the strong controls of the feudal state that people lived in. Now nobody can tell us what to think. We can think on our own. We can do on our own. That was a reaction to the conditions of their time. And since that time, that issue has been embellished many, many times, especially in the United States where I live, where we have essentially a whole political party that really believes in nothing but free market activities and individual activities. And today, a social narrative has emerged in Western nations, and especially in the U.S., that I call a culture of extreme individualism, which is really very new in historic terms. The extreme individualism we now live in. This is a brand new phenomenon historically. And what it does is it leaves most people and most organizations, public and private organizations, pretty much unconcerned or unaware of the consequences of their actions on the systems they're part of. They're not even sure what systems they're part of because we haven't really spent time doing that. And in fact, we're told that if everyone is just responsible for themselves, it doesn't matter what you do. In fact, instead, go out there and pursue your own individual self-interest as aggressively as you can, and everything will magically work out for the best. We have a whole department of economics at the University of Oregon that teaches that. And just a little self-reflection and looking around you at the experience that we're now having indicates that that view is just patently wrong and extremely dangerous. Think about your own life. When you've aggressively pursued your own interests, when you acted selfishly in your family, what was the reaction? That usually doesn't go over too well, right? People have a reaction to that. Here in the West, we pursued our own economic self-interest by burning fossil fuels, without any concern for the larger climate system we were part of. And now we have pushed the climate to the point where we're on the verge of uncontrollable climate change. The Western financial centers, especially Wall Street in the U.S., pursued their own financial economic interest without considering the broader economy they were part of, and collapsed basically now the whole world economy in 2008, 2009. Some of your financial folks here were part of that and other countries also. So we can see that this idea that it's okay to pursue your own self-interest, that is to act selfishly without considering the broader systems you're part of, just doesn't pay off all that much. We have confused self-centeredness with individual freedom. And because of that, we are much less free. That's what we have to deal with. And this leads to what I call the second natural law of sustainability, the law of cause and effect. Everything that happens emerges out of what preceded it. And in today's overcrowded, overconsumed, overheating and super interconnected world, everything we do now creates the opportunities and the conditions for what's going to be possible in the future. Of course, this is what in Buddhism is called karma, right? What we do matters. Your actions have consequences. Everything has its causes and conditions. The only level of reality that does not have causes and conditions is, in Buddhist terms, nibbana. All else is a result of causes and conditions. And this is deeper and goes deeper into our awareness that we mostly go on an everyday basis. But it's going to be how the path forward for us. We must all now understand, and I think people on the East Coast of the U.S. might begin to grasp this now, the rest of the week, that every word we speak, every action we take, every product we use, every kilowatt of fossil fuel-based energy we use, every technology we develop, every policy we develop, is likely to have an effect on someone, somehow, here or somewhere else around the world at some point in the future or in the future. And so the law of cause and effect in the world we now live in, for environmental problems and social problems, that our communications and our economies are globalized, the law of cause and effect is ubiquitous. It matters more today than ever before. And this leads to the second natural law of the second commitment involved with the shift from me to we, that is the core of sustainable thinking and acting. Take responsibility for all of the consequences of your actions. Okay, so we first said the natural law of interdependence. Understand the systems you're part of. See your context. Now, once you understand that, we have to understand what the consequences of our actions are on the systems we're part of. Now, of course, it's difficult to try to understand all the consequences of our actions because we're part of an economic system that is globalized, where information is very difficult to get. It's just a very challenging process. It's very difficult to know what's in most of the products you're using, what you purchase, etc. But this commitment is about right intention and right thought. It's about understanding that we have choices and that if we really want a path out of the suffering we're going through now individually and as a society and as a culture, we're going to have to make different choices. We're going to have to look deeper and deeper at the consequences of our actions and make different choices. You know, the Buddha addressed this issue. The Buddha saw that everyone wanted to be happy. But people were normally pushing on the exact wrong levers to get there. To become happy, we would push on our own self-interest. When in fact, what we needed to do was become more selfless. He said, we have dust in our eyes. Even when we know the impacts of our activities, we blind ourselves to them. And that's, of course, why we practice meditation. To clear our minds and to try to see things pretty clearly. And as the Buddha said, suffering is the key to change. I know that from being a psychologist also, when I used to practice that, people didn't come to see me. Families, I work with delinquent families or troubled families, they didn't come to see me when everything was really good. They came to see me because they were in trouble. They were stressed and distressed. So suffering is what can trigger us to change. See if that actually occurs on the East Coast of the U.S. This week. Therefore, it's important to understand that only when there is dissonance will we actually likely make a change. And so the more you can become aware of the consequences of your actions on other people or the Earth's climate and ecological systems, the better off you're going to be. And it is likely to create some distress. In fact, it can create some overwhelming guilt and sense of gloom when you really understand what's going on. But it is also an incredibly empowering experience It's been that way in my life, and I know in many of the people we work with, because if we now understand that we've made choices that have led to these consequences, we now have the power to make different choices. We're not powerless. We actually have a tremendous amount of power. We can change our karma, in other words, through skillful means and by making different choices. So, if it's okay with you, I would like to do another little exercise. And let's investigate this natural law just a little bit. So I again invite you to close your eyes, sit quietly, and follow your breath for a moment or so. Once again, open to the feeling of your breath as it comes in and out of your body. And relax your body into the support provided by your chair. I'd like you just to spend a moment clarifying your intentions for sitting during this brief time. If you're willing, I'd like you to focus this next few minutes on your intention to look deeply at the consequences of your speech or personal behaviors on the social and ecological systems you're part of. That is, on other people and the Earth's other organisms. Now look back, if you would, at the last few days before you came to tonight's events and try to recall interactions you had with different people. For example, if you remember some conversations you had with someone or a number of people, or some work you did with someone. Also notice the people you might have only given a nod to or some other type of modest acknowledgement to. And notice people you might have just ignored. Now contemplate how you interacted with these people. Were you honest? Were you humble? Were you helpful? Did you show kindness to everyone? Were you legitimately concerned about their well-being? Or were you abrupt in some way? Or condescending? Or gave them very little of your attention because you were thinking of yourself or your self-image or your own personal needs and wants and not theirs? If you fell into those traps, how did the people respond? Is there one particularly uncomfortable or painful experience in particular that you can remember? And if so, spend a few moments exploring that interaction. Can you locate the underlying energy of desire for things to be different? Or the feeling of self-centeredness? Or the sense of craving that the Buddha talked about in the Second Noble Truth? Can you notice any of that? Where that, those feelings were inside you? don't judge yourself one way or the other during this exercise. Just notice what happened without becoming attached to it. I'd like you to invite you to look back and acknowledge all the ways you interacted with the Earth's climate and ecological systems in the past few days. So look at the food you ate, the products you purchased or used, your forms of transportation, and the energy you might have used during those processes or in your home. During these activities and these interactions, how aware were you of what you were doing? Did you consciously tread lightly by using as few materials and as little energy as possible? And did you purchase only what was essential? Or did you do things or consume things out of habit, as if on autopilot? Did your interactions help restore the planet? Or did they result in significant waste and pollution? Again, the point here is not to judge yourself one way or the other during this exercise, but to simply notice what occurred without becoming attached to it, and let the feelings go that you had around them, and just let it go. As the Buddha said, awareness is everything. So if you would now take a moment to honor your intention to look at the consequences of your actions. You have given yourself a precious gift of mindfulness. And you've also given everyone else a special gift as well by increasing your mindfulness. So thank yourself for that gift and open your eyes and come back to the room. I'm not going to leave you hanging with that, so we'll come back to this in a few seconds. But I want to have you take a journey with me now, a different journey. Okay? I want you to imagine that a genie has come and swept you away from your everyday duties and the job you have or the family you live in, whatever, and made you the most powerful decision maker on earth. You've just been scooped away, and now you're the most powerful decision maker on earth. At your fingertips is all the information you need to make any decision you want, and whatever you decide is going to affect everyone everywhere. But, of course, with this kind of exercise, there's always a catch, right? This genie has given you a special form of amnesia. You can't remember what your name is, where you live, if you have a family, what your nationality is, what your religion is, what your economic status is. You can't remember anything about yourself. All you know is whatever you decide is what's going to happen. Okay? You're the most powerful decision maker on earth. How would you make decisions under that kind of circumstance? Anybody have any suggestions?
I would try and utilitarian judgment about reducing suffering, increasing positive.
Okay. Try to reduce suffering. Okay. Anybody else want to?
I wouldn't make a decision on my own. Make it a communal concept.
Okay. You try to get as many people involved as you can.
But you need to be quite egalitarian, because if you didn't know where you were or who you, where you come from, you're trying to treat everybody more equally, so that the goodness would be distributed.
Okay, great. So you'd have to try to be very egalitarian, so that everyone is equally treated. Anybody else have any alternative?
I was wondering about going even further than that and looking at the poorest people on Earth and how my decision was going to affect them. It comes from something Gandhi said, I think.
Okay, you want to address this? Why would you be concerned about the poorest?
Well, it's taking the equality idea even further. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to correct the inequality. Rather than giving everybody... I'm not sure about this, it was just an idea.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would be interested in it. So I think to make things more equal.
I think that's right. I think all of you have hit on the core elements of it. Let me use my own terms. I think you would adopt a decision-making mechanism somewhat similar to the age-old moral principle called the Golden Rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, because those others might be you. Right? You don't know who you are. Right? Would you make any other... Now, let me ask you, many of you work in different kind of businesses, et cetera. Under that scenario that I just described, would you use cost effectiveness as a decision-making mechanism? You don't know who you are? Would you? Probably not, right? Okay, that's what most of us do now, right? You know, how much it costs, how much is that?
I don't know who it's costing.
That's right, that's right.
It's something which is cost effective for one group of people, it could be very damaging for another.
That's exactly right. As far-fetched as that scenario seems, although, and it's probably it would be a good thing if some of you in the room here became the most powerful people on Earth, that would be a good thing for many of us. What I just described is actually reality today. And that's what we haven't gotten our heads around. When you drive your vehicle, when you turn on your electricity here in London, if it's based on fossil fuels, like when people in the U.S. drive their vehicles and they make the gas, carbon emissions are going up into the atmosphere and affecting people all over the globe. And they have no idea it's happening. Okay? And vice versa. China is producing a tremendous amount of carbon dioxide with fossil fuel-based energy that is affecting all of us here and all of you also. We are all now affecting everyone because we've globalized our problems, created a different environment. And we have got to decide on what our moral and ethical response is going to be. Can't be cost effectiveness. People in the U.S. argue about, well, it's too expensive to reduce emissions to protect the climate, which is one of the most absurd ideas I've ever heard. It's too expensive to save us from having more and more these Hurricane Sandys? How can that be? You spend whatever it takes just to address these problems. And this is what mainstream language I call the natural law of moral justice. And this is the third natural law of sustainable thinking and acting, or the shift from me to we that is critical. And in Buddhist terms, we call this sila, moral conduct. Okay? Which in the Buddhism is the foundation of a peaceful life. The Buddha talks about that all the time. You have to adopt a clear set of moral and ethical guidelines. Morality is a confusing term to many of us. But morality is about what we believe our duties and responsibilities are to other people. What's fair and unfair, just and unjust. That's what morality is about. And given the situation that we're now in today, that I just described, we have to decide on what our moral obligations are and ethical obligations are to other people. And society's most universal moral obligation one that is adopted by every religion that I've looked at around the world, and embedded in most laws, is to do no harm. The Buddha talked about that. He said, if you can't do good, at least do no harm. And so that's the starting point. Once we understand the context in which we exist, the systems in which we exist, and we begin to understand our consequences on those systems, we then have to adopt the moral principle to do no harm. We have to stop unraveling the climate system, stop doing these activities. We need to constrain our innate, selfish, and aggressive aspects, which we have. All of us have that. We know we have that. But now we need to adopt some constraints on that. In the Dharma terms, the sila is about abstaining from taking life and abstaining from taking something that is not freely given to you by others. And when you think about climate change, both of those principles we're really violating. We are affecting life here in England and around the world. I think we're going to find that out in the east coast of the U.S. pretty soon, the next day or two. And we're eliminating the options for future generations without their giving us that option. They haven't given us that right, but we're doing that by pursuing our own economic self-interest. So this is a very important principle, to do no harm, the moral principle to do no harm. Again, it's about constraining ourselves and adopting some very clear ethical and moral guidelines for how we're going to live our lives, how we're going to run our businesses and our organizations, how we're going to run our energy systems. The starting point is to do no harm. So I want to spend just a few minutes, if you would, and just a short exercise to explore this commitment. And again, if you would, start by focusing on your breath and just relaxing into your chair. And I invite you to start by focusing on your intention to make a commitment to moral justice, or to sila, and also to creating greater mindfulness about how you practice moral justice in your life. So I'd like to ask you to start by articulating to yourself, saying to yourself, the moral and ethical principles you strive to live by. Can you clearly state those? Can you clearly identify those? Do you have a firm commitment to refraining from taking life? Or from in other ways, not harming other people or the Earth's ecological systems? Remember that none of us is perfect, that in fact we all participate in taking life in some form, intentionally or unintentionally. Our bodies kill bacteria all the time, for example. So it is our intention that matters the most here. If our intention in our minds and in our hearts is to do no harm, then even when we mess up, as long as our intention is clear, we can do better next time. I want to invite you to recall the previous exercise we did, where your awareness was focused on the interactions you had with other people and the environment. Notice again any particularly painful or unskillful interaction you had with another person, holding your moral principles front and center now in your awareness? Is there anything you would want to do differently next time? Imagine meeting that person again in the future. Maybe it's next week. How could you abide by your moral principles and interact with them in a different way next time? Imagine the same process, same kind of interaction you had with the Earth's climate and ecological systems that we reflected on, the food you ate, the things you purchased or used, or the energy you used. Keeping your moral principles in mind, is there anything you would do differently next time? As we have done in the past, say thank you to yourself for the efforts you've now given to increase your mindfulness. What a gift you've given yourself. And give thanks for the gift you've given to other people and to the Earth's climate and environment by increasing your mindfulness. And when you're ready, come back to the room and open your eyes. Anybody want to share anything that you experienced there? Did it make a difference to go and think consciously about your moral principles when you thought back about some experience you've had? Anybody want to share anything? How many of you are able to consciously articulate the moral and ethical principles that you use to guide your life? I find it difficult for many of us, even those of us who have tried to focus on the Dharma. And it's not that we don't live out those principles often, it's just we haven't consciously tried to sort of list them, if you will. But it's a very powerful exercise to try to do that. To do it. And when I work with a lot of organizations, I'm going to meet with the City of London Sustainability Office tomorrow. I'll have to do that. And if this is understanding the consequences of your action can be distressing, so can the fact that they realize they don't have any moral principles. That's not to say they don't act ethically, but they haven't clearly articulated how it is they're going to make decisions in the future. What principles are we going to use? Just to try to clarify and surface that, get a dialogue going in your own life, in your family, in the organizations you work with is really very, very important, especially given the conditions we're now in today, which is a whole different situation, like I said, than we humanity's ever been. We've never been down this path before, where we have these sort of global forces that we're right on the edge of allowing to get out of control. Many scientists say it's already out of control. We've already passed the tipping point. We'll see. So I want to ask you now to take one more little trip with me, if you will, and imagine the picture of the Earth. I had a PowerPoint, I would put it up there, that the Apollo 17 astronauts took in 1972. Do you remember that picture of the Earth? It's the first time humanity ever had a picture of our home as a freestanding entity. You see that in your mind's eye? Okay. Now look closely at that picture. And tell me if you see any intake valves coming in from another planet, allowing us to bring other resources in when we use up our natural resources or contaminate them and we can't use them any further. Look carefully. Don't see it. Now look again. Look very carefully. And see if you see any discharge pipes allowing us to get rid of our pollution and waste. And if you look really carefully, you won't see it. Everything we humans do, and that picture says it all, the blue marble, it's called. Everything we humans do and make stays right here on our planet or in our immediate atmosphere. That's just the way the world works. Okay? There's a few things that escape in the atmosphere, but not much. And the scientific community is now debating, I think has decided, in fact, that humanity has now entered a new geological era that they call the Anthropocene. Anybody ever heard that term, Anthropocene? This is the term that means that rather than natural processes determining the fate of life on Earth, human activities are going to determine the fate of life on Earth. Again, never before in a position like this. But from climate disruption to ocean acidification to the breakdown of biodiversity, loss of biodiversity, etc., what we do now will determine what organisms live in the future, where they will live, what their habitat's going to look like, and us too. There's going to be some big shifts happening. There already are underway. That's the Anthropocene, human-driven change on the planet. And so our activities now are going to determine the fate of life on Earth. And it's a universal moral principle, moral axiom, that the more power one has over another, the more we must use that power benevolently. And this leads to the fourth natural law of sustainability, as I call it, the law, natural law of trusteeship. The Earth is now, can be considered a living trust. I'm sure in financial matters here in the UK, you have financial trusts, right, where people have given their money to a group of folks and entrusted them with managing those resources, maybe it's a building, some sort of capital, managing those resources into perpetuity to benefit the beneficiaries. Okay? And we have now are in the same position in terms of how we manage the Earth. We are now trustees. And what we do and how we manage this will determine what happens in the future. That's the law of trusteeship. And we have to remember that I'm in my mid-60s almost, and I'm not going to, I mean, I hope to live for the next 40, 50 years, but I won't be here forever, and none of you will either, right? We're all here just for a short period of time, which means we don't really own anything, right? I can't take what I have with me wherever I go. We might hold title to what we own, we have right now temporarily, but we're going to leave it behind to someone else, to other people. And that's the same thing with the Earth now. We are the trustees. We're only here temporarily. We have to act as trustees and realize that we have to take care of this, which means we have to try to protect all life on Earth. In Buddhist terms, trusteeship involves first the cultivation of non-attachment, the understanding that we just let things go. We can't be attached to anything. But it also requires equanimity, as we were talking about before. We have to see all people and all organisms as equals and not show favoritism on what we're going to try to help and what we're not going to try to help. And those two principles are combined with karuna, which is caring, compassion for all organisms, all sentient beings, and mudita, which is taking joy in the well-being of others. We have to try to restore the well-being of others. And this leads to the fourth commitment involved with the shift from me to we, that that to me is at the core of sustainable thinking and acting, or the core of the shift from selfishness to selflessness, and that is acknowledge your trustee obligations and take responsibility for the continuation of all life. All people and all future generations have a right to live on a healthy planet. And so this commitment takes us well beyond doing no harm to now doing good. It's about magnifying our innate, selfless, caring, and compassionate traits, which we have just as much of or greater than those other urges, and trying to restore our degraded and tattered ecological and social systems. So, as the Buddha said, first, do no harm. That's the principle of moral justice. After we do that, and the reason I split this up in this way, we then have to do good. The reason I split it up is because most of the organizations I work with, it's going to be an enormous task to try to figure out how to do no harm. Because we've got an economic structure set up that is really a very violent system. Very violent and unjust. And so it's a huge change to figure out how to do that. And there is a lot of activity going on to try to do no harm. The desire to reduce emissions, to become carbon neutral from that perspective, that's about doing no harm. Okay? But doing good is just about, is a very different kind of activity. It's about moving to 100% renewables, as an example. But we're just simply not going to harm things. We're actually going to try to restore things. It's about moving from a 15 or 20% increase in recycling rates to, in fact, no waste. Okay? To using processes called biomimicry that you might have heard of, where we begin to make products and services to mimic the way nature functions, where we phase out all synthetic chemicals because they are doing violence. And we go to green chemistry, which is actually trying to make processes of chemicals based on the way nature works. We have most of the tools, most of the techniques, and certainly the knowledge and know-how to do good and restore the climate system. In fact, even though many climate scientists think we're at the tipping point already or beyond it, my sense and the scientists I work with are that, no, that's not quite true. If we actually apply all of the knowledge and know-how and technologies and skills we already have, we can substantially reduce global warming and give us enough time to sort of make it to the other end. Now, of course, there's huge political obstacles in the way and a lot of inertia, but from a technical perspective, we know how to do this. So don't get discouraged. We can't. It's the inertia in our heads mostly. That gets us in the way, and then all the other political self-centered issues that get in the way about who's going to lose money and not make money and all those kind of things. So this is a really, really important commitment because it really takes us much deeper. It takes your practice, your meditation practice, your Dharma practice much deeper than normal. Once you see that you are part of something much larger than yourself, you're connected to systems that are much larger than you, and you understand cause and effect, your consequences and the consequences of all the other people around you on those systems, and the importance of doing no harm to those systems now, the vital importance in that. Again, 100 to 150 years ago, that wasn't necessarily the case, although the Buddha said yes to you. Was the case. You know, things weren't as tattered and weren't as filled in 150, 200 years ago. So we could do some harm here without collapsing the climate system. But now we can't. We're in a different era. But once you understand that, and then you realize that what we do now will determine the fate of all life on Earth from this point forward, you have the obligation to use that power that you have benevolently by caring for and trying to restore the systems you're part of. And again, this is a very different way, I think, than most people think. We tend to want to ignore our responsibilities to care for all life because it's just too big a burden. my gosh, I'm responsible for all that? That's a pretty big burden. But once you become aligned with the principles of the Dharma, and you find out that caring for all life, in fact, is not a burden, it is a great joy. It's a joy that comes with a lot of sorrow, a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, but it's also tremendous joy. And I'm not speaking out of school, I think, when I say it this, but my wife is a veterinarian. And she is the person I look at all the time who illustrates this principle. She goes to work every day, sometimes comes home crying because she's lost an animal that they tried so hard to save. And yet, in trying, she is filled with such joy and meaning and purpose in her life that it is just a life commitment to do that. She feels tremendous power, tremendous happiness, tremendous sense of well-being by doing that. And many, many times, in fact, she comes home and says, "We saved one," which, of course, makes it all worthwhile. So once we take on this commitment, I think what we'll do is we'll find that there is an opportunity here to give purpose in life to people in our societies. And so many people lack a sense of meaning and purpose. I think this is an opportunity to create a whole new sense of purpose for people that is really desperately missing, especially in the U.S., where consumerism and materialism is what we are told we are all about. We are only around simply buying more stuff to keep the economy going, which leaves people with a deep sense of lack of meaning. If I'm only someone who's supposed to buy stuff, I'm a consumer, I'm not a person, there's not a good sense. But if now we realize your job, in fact, is, and the East Coast is going to find this out, we have to go restore our systems. We have to build resiliency to the impacts of climate change that are now inevitable, and then reduce our contribution to the problem as quickly as we can so that eventually the system begins to stabilize itself again. That's really the only two things in front of us. If you're running a business or an organization that is not trying to help people do one of those two things, my guess is in the next 5, 10 years, your business is going to become increasingly irrelevant. That's the only things that matter. We have to build resilience, and we have to reduce our contribution to this problem. And there's a lot of ways to do that. So you help, it means food systems, it means transportation, it means recreating an economy in, to me, an incredibly exciting way. This is the start of the next economic revolution, and the business and job opportunities are unlimited if we think about doing no harm and now taking responsibility for all life, doing good, adopting clear moral principles, and thinking of ourselves as trustees. I think that's great. So I personally am extremely optimistic about the future. I think it's going to be a rough period of time ahead, but I think we're going to come out of it in better shape once we understand this. So just for a second, I'm not going to do an exercise here, but we'll do one in a second. I just want you to think about, can you envision for yourself becoming a trustee? Thinking about yourself as a trustee for all life that is. Can you think about yourself? Can you imagine yourself caring for all organisms? And trying to think about your mission in life now is trying to restore ecological systems and natural systems and helping people along the way. And can you see, try to imagine in your own self the unlimited capacity you have to serve as a trustee? So now let's talk about the fifth and final natural law, the law of free will, and the final commitment, which is to choose your own destiny. This is about the Dharma principle that if we break free from the illusions that control our minds about how the way the world works and our role in it, we are free to make different choices. The Buddha talked about this all the time. We can change our karma by making different choices. And although self-centeredness existed in the Buddha's time, this trait, as I said, has been magnified many times over in Western society today, to the extent that we now have this culture of extreme individualism that we live in. But we have to understand that this culture of extreme individualism came about because of specific choices that were made by our predecessors in response to the conditions of their time. As I said, it started 350 years ago, roughly, with the reaction to the feudal church and feudal lords that controlled people's thinking, movement, economy, etc. We said, no, we are independent selves. And a good deal of it, many of us don't think about it, a good deal of the embellishment that's happened on that idea happened right after World War II, when what happened was, because of the mobilization of resources in the U.S. and in Europe, in England especially here, to address this, the problem we had, we created technologies, that is, industrial processes never before seen on Earth. So we were able to produce goods and services at much higher rates than anybody could absorb them. Okay? If you look back at the history, and I spent quite a bit of time doing this a number of years back, it's fascinating to see that business leaders, government leaders, and marketing leaders at the time got together and said, we have, every time we increase productivity, and now that's what happened in the war, we increased our productive capacity, which means how much goods and services we could produce per unit of, per person hour. Every time we did that, we needed more people, or people to buy more to absorb the goods we could now produce more of. So there was an explicit decision made, a set of explicit decisions made in the 50s, basically, to promote consumption, massive consumption, and to turn people into basically materialistic consumers, and also to promote population growth. Because the more people you had, the more you could go, and the more people there would be to buy stuff. So we basically had to keep consumption growing faster than productivity, or, and what they were experiencing at the time, which led to this, you have continual recessions, right? Companies had a bunch of extra stock. There wasn't enough people to buy the stuff. They'd have to stop making the stuff, okay? They had to lay people off, et cetera. They said, how do we fix this? We need people to buy a lot of stuff and keep buying, and we need more people to do it. There's a great book, if you haven't read it, called The Waste Makers by Vance Packard. An old name, I think it was 1960 he wrote it, that just details out this whole process. So our consumer culture did not come about by chance. It came about because of specific decisions that were made in response to the conditions of those times, right or wrong. In fact, there was a lot of discussion in those days about that, well, what is this going to lead to? What if we run out of resources? Is this going to be, and they said, well, we'll leave that to the future. We be the future. We're it. They left it to us, and we're now dealing with it. Okay? But the point is, it's not to disparage those folks. They were doing what they thought was best, given the conditions of their time. The point is that societies have changed their core beliefs and core thinking and their activities and therefore their economic structures many times throughout history. And every time they did that, most people ended up much better off. Even the decision to promote consumption and population growth created the greatest economic boom in history, right? Never before in anywhere in the world had anybody, any country seen this kind of economic wealth that we now have in the Western world. Now, it came with some unintended consequences because we didn't think about the systems we were promoting. But nevertheless, every time a society has made some fundamental decisions like that, everyone has, for the most part, ended up better off. So we can change our social consciousness. We can change the social narrative. We can individually change the way we think because we've done it many times in the past. And every time you personally have done it in your life, I'm sure you've ended up better off. You've ended up happier, feeling more at peace. And we can do it. And society does it as well. The Buddha said that Know well what leads you forward and what holds you back, and choose the path that leads to wisdom. And that's really our challenge ahead of us now. If we change our beliefs, our assumptions and beliefs about the world, we will begin to act differently. If we see the systems we're part of, understand the consequences of our systems, of our activities on those systems, etc., we will begin to act differently. If we act differently, we'll start to get different outcomes and different results. Human behaviors are based on our beliefs, on the way of seeing the world. And the way if we change our beliefs, we begin to act differently. If we act differently, we will create different outcomes. And in Buddhist terms, this is panna, it's called, which is developing the wisdom that leads us out of the suffering and leads us towards nibbana. And it is developed by right concentration. I call it commitment, but it's meditation in Buddhism. And in part also by prioritizing what's important in your life, by making a commitment, if you will. And having a sangha like London Insight is very important also, to do that together with other people, because you don't want to be on your own as you try to make these kind of changes. So, as I said when we started, climate disruption and growing economic inequality and the collapse of the economy, and so many of today's other problems are not really about poor technologies or use of fossil fuels. Of course, those are the direct results, the direct consequences. Happiness and suffering are states of mind, and are the outcome of our state of mind. And the causes of our troubles cannot, therefore, be found outside of the mind. This stuff is about how we see the world, how we perceive the world, and therefore our actions are driven by our perceptions. And if we want to find happiness, if we want to be free of suffering, including the reduction of global warming and economic inequality, we must first get control of our minds. Just as the Buddha said 2,000 years ago or more, way more than that. So this leads to the fifth and the most empowering commitment involved with the shift from me to we, that is the core of sustainable thinking and acting. Choose your own destiny. We do not have to be stuck with the current path we're on, even though it seems impossible to change. It seems overwhelming to try to act differently, given the structure of the society we live in, but we can. We can free ourselves anytime we want from the constraints of our collectively held illusions about how the planet works and our role in it. We can make the shift from me to we. So, in summary, the five commitments, the five natural laws and commitments are the law of interdependency, or anatta, no self, independent origination, and the commitment is see the ecological systems and social systems you're part of. Then the law of cause and effect, or karma, be accountable for all the consequences of your actions on those systems. And third, the law of moral justice, or sila, abide by society's universally held moral principles and ethical principles, especially the one saying, do no harm. Fourth, trusteeship, which then means non-attachment, karuta and mudita, which means to acknowledge your trustee obligations and take responsibility for the continuation of all life. And finally, the law of free will, or panna, which means the commitment is to choose your own destiny. I'd like you just to sort of sit for a minute and think about where you personally come out with on those five natural laws and natural commitments. How often do you find yourself aware of them, following them? How often are you not? And then turn to somebody close to you and just share what you came up with. It could be a threesome. Just share what you experienced tonight so far. And then as soon as we're done, I will close up with a few other comments. But just to observe yourself, see what comes to mind, and then share that with a friend.